This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for November 3rd, 2016, the Is It Tuesday Yet edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura, Emily Bazelon of the New York Times. You are down the line somewhere. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
John Dickerson of Face the Nation. You are also down the line somewhere. Hello, John.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
Where are you spending election night, John? In New York?
In New York City.
In the studio, in a CBS studio?
In a CBS studio. We'll start at 6:30 in the evening for the evening news, and then we'll be on until, we're scheduled to be on at least until 2 in the morning. So that's, we got a long night ahead of us.
Yeah. On this week's Gabfest, the election is 5 days away, and the polls are narrowing. How close is it? Then James Comey's letter to Congress about the Huma Wiener Hillary emails upends the race. Did Comey act appropriately? How much effect will his letter have on the election? Then I'm calling an audible. We were going to talk about Trump and taxes in Russia, but I'm just saying no, we're not, because our new topic is going to be how to deal with pre-election anxiety, because I, David Plotz, need your help. Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter, and for Slate Plus, the acquittal of Ayman Bundy and the other Malheur. How do you pronounce that? I don't even know. Malheur protesters.
That I don't know.
If you are not yet a Slate Plus member,
Malheur.
I know. But I'm just choosing to anglicize one part of it, but not the other. But okay, the Bad Hour protesters. It was a long, long, many hours. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus. Also, a reminder, we have our conundrum show coming up at the end of November. Please send us conundrums you would like us to discuss to gabfest@slate.com or @SlateGabFest by Twitter, and hashtag them, in either case, conundrum, #conundrum, so that we will see them. We need some good conundrums. 5 days out, I have lost it, honestly. Just a heads up, I have been unable to take in any information about the election anymore. I am too despairing. I'm too sad. I'm too scared. I've run out of words and thoughts. I tried yesterday to read about the election and to read the wonderful preparation document that intern Kevin made for us. I was unable to do it, which is an issue because we have a Gabfest to do. But,
but John
it's gonna
is
going to
enlighten us. He is strong enough to tell us everything.
It's a testament to how good a job I can do without basic preparation. This show will be a testament to that. I'm going to be trumping it on this show, basically. So, John, what's going on in the polls? Is this narrowing, the expected narrowing, or is there something deeper happening that is giving Trump a real advantage?
Well, I guess if you want to say expected, it's expected in this sense. If you look at the bouncing of the polls that has taken place pretty consistently since before the conventions, it is a true thing. Two things are true: that whoever the candidate is that's in the center of the news cycle is the candidate that's not doing well. Secondly, and sort of corollary to that, is that when Donald Trump is out of the news cycle for getting in fight with Gold Star families, challenging the ruling that could be made by a judge because of his parents' country of birth, talking about Muslim, banning all Muslims from coming to the United States, talking about or being heard on a video boasting about sexual assault, when all of that stuff is in the news, attacking a former Miss Universe, when he's in the news doing something objectionable, his numbers drop. And who do they drop with? They drop with Republicans, and particularly white college educated Republicans. He has dropped and lost white college women pretty significantly. That seems to be a loss that he's taken. When he is not in the news, when he is, as Republicans, including people in his campaign, referred to as on teleprompter, those Republicans start to come back. The first ones that appear to be coming back are white college-educated men. In the CBS poll on the 19th of October, he was down to 37% among white college-educated men. That was a 10-point drop from the previous poll, which I think was taken on the 4th of October. So that was a huge drop. A bunch of other polls showed the same decline among white men, and particularly white college-educated men. This was both a result of the things he'd said about women, the Billy Bush tape, his performance in the debates, but it was also as a result of a specific effort by the Clinton campaign and their allies to appeal to white college-educated men and to essentially say, you have daughters, you have wives, how are you going to explain to them your vote for Donald Trump, given what he said about women? Those men are now back. In the CBS News poll that was released on the 3rd of November, Trump's number among white college-educated men is at 45. So whatever qualms they may have had, they have gotten rid of them. Or they just have, you know, they're resetting their opinions when he's not in the news. So what's happening, this is a large way of saying what's happening, is the tightening in the polls you're seeing is Republicans coming home. And then the other problem is Hillary Clinton has issues with some of her base. This is maybe less of a poll thing and more of a just what to watch for on Tuesday thing, which is she has got weakness in the African-American community, which is why you see this real push on the part of the president. And, you know, they're having a Jay-Z concert and Stevie Wonder's going to do a concert. There's a real concern that they're just not turning out their African-American base as much as they would like.
Emily, what's the evidence about that question around African-Americans? In North Carolina, I know there's an enormous concern that in early voting, African-Americans are not voting in the numbers that the Clinton campaign would like or expected, and certainly not at the numbers that they voted.
Right. It's also true in Florida that the numbers are down. In North Carolina, one thing to point out is there are parts of the state where a significant number of polling places in heavily black areas has dropped significantly. So there's one part of the state where there were 30 polling places, now there's one. So it may not simply be that these black voters are less excited about Hillary Clinton. It may also be that it has just been made harder for them to vote.
Right, right. And there are litigation and judges intervening or talking about what's going on in North Carolina as being something out of Jim Crow.
Yes, that's true. One thing to note is that the Hispanic turnout in the early voting in Florida and I think North Carolina is up. So that's significant. It's up in particular with people who don't vote very often or haven't voted before. And I've been reporting this week on efforts to really turn out that vote. And it's been really interesting to learn about. And so that's a kind of Clinton bright spot, presumably. Although, of course, African-Americans break for Democrats, you know, like 9-1. And for Hispanics, it's more like 2/3 to 1/3.
If I could just interject very briefly on what they call jargon watch, the low propensity voter. The reason you want your low propensity voters voting early is that they obviously take a lot more of your effort. So if you can get them to vote early, if you rank voters on their intent to vote from 1 to 10, if your 2s and 3s and 4s are voting early, you know your 10s are going to vote.
What's the evidence we have so far, John, about the relative strength of the ground games? The Clinton campaign has banked a lot of hope on the idea that they're prepared all over the country. They're prepared. They've done a ton of work. They have field offices. They have canvassers. They're just out and about. And the Trump folks are more like, hey, we have a media campaign and that's going to excite people. As we get near Election Day, how do those two arguments hold up?
I think they pretty much hold up. There are two different designs here as well. So the Clinton campaign did the Obama model, which is they built their own ground game, essentially separate and apart from the Democratic National Committee. It is a lot of Obama veterans, and it is as state-of-the-art as as it can be. So there's all of the science and all of the testing of messages and mobilization and persuasion that Sasha Eisenberg and others have been writing about for the last several years. So that means that they say in the cliche when you talk about the ground game is that a good ground game is like a field goal. You have to get really close, but then if you have a good ground game, it can give you those last few points. And so if you are a despairing Democrat, and that might be a redundancy, then you've got to look at the integration between the Clinton ground game and data and analytics operations and think that's going to be helpful to her. The Republicans took a different approach, which is that Reince Priebus, when he did the autopsy or commissioned the autopsy in 2012, it was an effort to both say the direction the party should go in, but also to build essentially a freestanding data analytics and turnout field operation for the party. And the hope was, we will build it, and then whoever the nominee is, we'll just hand it over to them. We'll know where all the Republicans live. We'll look at all of this consumer data, know what they want, do all the stuff that the Clinton people are doing, but we'll do it in the party, and then we'll just hand it over. So that's where we are now. And the question of this campaign will be, did the Republican Party do all of its work? And they appear to be doing it, A, better than in the past, and B, pretty well, in terms of targeting voters, knowing how to get them out, knowing the messages that will move them. But then what happened in the handoff between the RNC and Trump? Did the Trump folks listen? Did the candidate listen? Did they go the places where they should because their vote, you know, would have benefited from a visit from the candidate? Did he talk and stay on message about certain things because they knew they could move, you know, their reluctant Republican voters? And there will be a series of tests. The biggest one or the bluntest one is just to look at the traditional Republican areas. Is turnout where you would expect it to be for a generic Republican. And you could just kind of look at Romney and McCain from last time and see how he's doing in the Republican areas based on those two previous performances. Then you want to look at the swing areas. And then the upside for Trump, but this is a problem or a challenge, is obviously those new Trump voters, whether they're on the eastern side of Ohio, in Mahoning County and around Youngstown, the kind of what would have been considered blue-collar Democrats. Are there enough of them coming from Trump? Those are people that he may be attracting, but they may also be low propensity voters, which would benefit from a ground game. And that's a huge question. Is there an operation to turn out the new kinds of voters that he might be appealing to? There's evidence they may be out there, but not that they are so numerous and that there's a system for getting to the polls that it's going to be the big, big factor. But we won't know till Tuesday.
Why do you think, Emily, that despite the fact that 300 newspapers have endorsed Hillary Clinton, the only newspapers that have endorsed Donald Trump are the KKK newspaper, the National Enquirer, and one Las Vegas newspaper owned by a conservative billionaire. Why do you think it is that the general media, the mainstream media condemnation of Trump has had as little impact as it has had?
Well, he's an anti-establishment candidate, and editorial page judgments are kind of a classic expression of the establishment. And also, when you look at the media coverage, some of it has been really helpful to Trump, especially in the last week and a half. I mean, we're going to talk about the FBI and Jim Comey in a little bit. But when you think about the headlines that are blaring, what people are talking about on television, it is as much about these questions about Hillary Clinton and whether she can be trusted as it is about, you know, Donald Trump's continuing missing tax returns and shenanigans. You know, one thing that really struck me this week was, I think, a Washington Post poll showing that Trump had a significant advantage among voters asked, who do you think is more trustworthy?
Oh, my fucking God, you're kidding.
Yes.
I'm not kidding.
And that's a reflection of the success that Trump has had in painting Clinton as, you know, as crooked. Like, this idea of crooked Hillary, I think, has caught in people's minds. And, yeah.
I think I would, I don't know if it's caught. They're, I mean, they've been kind of, for a long time, they were sort of neck and neck on trust, and then he has been ahead of her for a little while. I'm not sure it's because Donald Trump is using the word crooked or talking about her. I think that she's had, obviously, a lot of challenges this election that go to that problem. there are.
You know, John, I just dispute that as a premise. She has had a normal number of challenges. She's somebody who has you know, certainly made mistakes, and she's had a normal number of challenges. She's had a political life where she has made errors. But if you compare it, like, by any reasonable calculus, his trust should be 1/50th of what hers is.
Right. You misunderstand. When you consider so if you've got an existing problem, each new incremental story about that problem causes an issue. So for him, when his problem comes into the news cycle, he tanks. So the point is not that you measure the one-to-one. It's that on this question, and by the way, there are more voters voting for her who think she's not trustworthy but are going to vote for her anyway. So the question of trust as a determinant of your ultimate vote is not that clear. But on the question of trust, each new article that comes out that says, you know, she had this private email server, or turns out she deleted all these emails, each one of those hits this specific question. When Donald Trump has problems on, you know, tells another whopper, it doesn't land in the same way. That's just the way voters process it. I mean, there have been more stories about how Donald Trump hasn't, like, in aggregate, hundreds more stories about how he's not telling the truth on everything from his position on the Iraq war to his tax returns to almost everything. I mean, there have been hundreds and hundreds of more stories, more fact checks, all of that. And yet the polls have not reflected that in terms of people's trustworthiness.
Well, but my conclusion is simply that we've become a country where partisanship and partisan identification has now overwhelmed other forms of thinking. And that's
depressing. I mean, that could be part of the that is certainly a really important thread. Well, but there's also sexism, which is, you know, depressing her numbers in some way, slightly or significantly. We don't really know, but there's that. And then there's the way in which this news dribbles out every day. Practically, there's some new WikiLeaks email to kind of pick through, and I find it hard to follow, so I'm sure that lots of other people are not that interested, and yet you're sort of left with this, like, kind of creeping, cloudy question mark feeling about her. Whereas when Trump lies or makes a really obvious false statement, it's like a big thing, and then it goes away. And then, as John said,
well, it goes away because
Trump
makes another big lie.
Trump can kind of control this by staying on teleprompter, whereas Clinton doesn't have control over what WikiLeaks or the FBI releases about her.
So, but I think we really need to separate the question of trust from the overall state of the race. So, because trust doesn't mean, I mean, it's clear that people are voting for both of them, even though they don't find them trustworthy. We're pretending there are these kind of voters in the middle. I think, David, you're right. It's essentially partisanship. And Donald Trump has, you know, some number. We don't know what that number is, but 30, high 30s, low 40s of people for whom new information about him, no matter what the kind, does not change their opinion about how they're going to vote. People are not uninformed. They're just choosing to give him a pass on all of that.
Right. They're just being unbelievably
irresponsible.
The other
thing I think we have to go back to a little bit is the gender and race divide that we touched on earlier. I mean, that is really striking. If Donald Trump wins this election, he is going to win with white people, in particular white men, and with low to zero support from certain other groups. I mean, essentially, he's going to win without black people. And that is, like, I can't quite get my mind around what that is actually going to look like and what that means for the country.
I'm ashamed of my fellow white men. I'm ashamed of us white men.
I think you're right. But Emily, that's worth just highlighting a little more, is that the demographic changes in the country that we've been tracking for the last several elections are not going to abate. They're not suddenly going to be more white men in America. In the next presidential election, they will be a smaller share of the election, as they have been a smaller share for the last several. So America is changing, and yet the election, if Donald Trump is elected, he will be a president from a previous electorate, essentially, going into a future
right.
That will
change
even more.
He will be a last-gasp president. And yet, we don't know what the impact of that will be going forward, obviously, because it is such an enormous question mark. I mean, I really feel like I have no idea what that will actually consist of, that presidency.
I have two white male sons, so I've gone from one to two. So the number of white men increasing.
It's all on you.
One last question, I guess, for you, John. Is there any fundamental shift in race dynamics still possible? We have just, you know, just the weekend, essentially.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean,
and yet last week we taped on a Thursday, and then on Friday Jim Comey made his announcement. So maybe we shouldn't say that it's impossible.
Well, but there may not be that much evidence that the Comey announcement did much.
Really mattered.
Well, yeah, I mean,
which would be very rational of the electorate, since it really shouldn't matter, since it was about so much uncertainty. But we can talk about that more in a moment.
The real question is just the one you raised at the beginning, which is about ground game. I mean, this is a question of who can turn out their voters and who has the model in place for working those voters and turning them out here.
Can I raise one more question about Election Day itself? You know, there have been reports that Trump advisor Roger Stone and other people are preparing, you know, really striking voter intimidation tactics, like planning to show up in black neighborhoods in cities like Philadelphia and Detroit and do everything they can to stop people from voting. I can't tell whether this is actually going to materialize or not. It's a problem for the RNC because they are under a consent decree not to do all of this. And so they're trying to distance themselves as much as possible from these elements of the Trump campaign. Do you guys have a sense of, you know, how big a factor this is? Or is it just like impossible to know in advance how that's actually going to play out? Like, part of me thinks it's just you just threaten all of these things and then you don't actually do them because that would be breaking the law.
I can't imagine this is going to be a big thing. Number one, there's not, people actually don't want to go do this. There are not huge numbers of people who actually want to go into an unfamiliar neighborhood.
Stand there with a gun. Polling place.
Yeah. And there might be an episode, an incident or two. I just think it is very unlikely that there's going to be this on any kind of wide scale. Two, it's likely to backfire.
Yes.
Because you will just make people want to vote even more. So it seems like just usual Roger Stone political dirty tricks theatrics that I doubt will turn into anything. But John?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. The I think this is all, you know, just he's messing with people.
So just to close the segment, I would just say so the race dynamics can't shift, but the one thing that can shift is that people can vote. So if you are in a swing state, get out and vote. Drive someone to the polls. Make your friends go vote. Be relentless about it. If you have a friend who's not planning on voting, make them show up and vote. This is an election where it actually matters. It's a difference between the survival of American democracy and its destruction. You have to get out and vote. So if you're listening to the show and you live in any state where the outcome is possibly up for grabs, get out and vote. I'm not telling you who to vote for. Just get out and vote.
Although implicit.
Yeah, I am telling you who to vote for. I'm just trying to play defense for you, John. I'm trying to protect
me too. I mean,
I'm trying to protect you guys.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
FBI Director James Comey sent an extraordinary letter to Congress last week saying that Hillary Clinton was going to prison, right, Emily?
No, he sent a letter that said almost nothing, but in its almost nothingness left that possibility seemingly like dangling out there.
What is the best case to make for what Comey did, Emily?
Well, so last summer when, you know, the FBI was in the midst of looking through all of Clinton's emails from a private server, Comey decided that he needed to give a public explanation about why the FBI had concluded that she should not be indicted. And this was highly unusual. Usually when law enforcement decides not to indict someone, they don't then spill that person's business all over the news, and they don't comment on it and give a kind of editorial judgment, as Comey did by calling her use of her server extremely careless. But Comey wrote a letter, issued a statement doing that, and then he gave a press conference, and as often happens at press conferences, kind of more information came out. His justification for this is that it was an extremely political and high-profile case, that the American people deserved an explanation. And I think also implicit in this is this idea that Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, had compromised herself by letting Bill Clinton talk to her on her airplane on her way to Aspen, Colorado, and that President Obama, in saying that he didn't think that Clinton had intentionally done anything, you know, terrible, had also kind of prejudged the investigation. And I think Comey kind of set himself up as the neutral law enforcement arbiter who was going to explain these conclusions. But in giving that explanation, Comey also promised to update Congress if anything changed. And then it seems, I think we've learned from the like enormous number of leaks from the FBI since Comey's letter last week, that there has been internal dissent in the FBI about what to do with this new cache of emails from Anthony Weiner's laptop, which are from Huma Abedin. And then also probably a fight going on about how much to investigate the Clinton Foundation and this whole question of whether there was improper influence when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. So the FBI is having like this internal fight. And it seems to me like the best explanation is that Comey felt like he had to answer to his FBI agents who've been criticizing the decision not to continue investigating and not to indict. And so it was a kind of defensive action that he took as the head of the FBI to issue this letter. And also there's his fear that the discovery of the Huma emails on Weiner's computer was going to leak anyway. So that's the justification that he felt like he had to go public. I think you can get yourself to some kind of announcement. I think it's a mistake. Like, I think last July was a mistake and is a misuse of the FBI's power and role. But what I find really inexcusable, as many other people have said at this point, is the totally vague, obfuscating question mark nature of that letter, which literally read as if like nobody had looked at it before Comey issued it. It just wasn't written for clarity or for reassuring people or giving the public a kind of fair sense of what was really still at play with these new Huma emails. And that I just find to be deeply disturbing.
John, what's the evidence so far about whether this has made a difference among voters?
Well, again, the if you already had the Republicans coming home to Donald Trump when he stayed out of the news, this kept a couple of more cycles.
Can you imagine if you actually had to fucking go home to Donald Trump, how terrible that would be? Like,
he'd
go home for Thanksgiving, and he'd just talk at you the whole time and grope your sister. Ugh. Anyway, go ahead. You were saying?
So Republicans who were coming home anyway and his staying out of the news cycle – this put a couple of days of him not being in the news cycle. So it allowed that to continue. And he didn't overreach particularly in his response to it. So I think in that way, it was probably helpful. I think the Democrats, of course, they're going to say this. So, you know, beware. But in a bunch of different ways, and in our polling and in other polling, we haven't seen a big drop off. I mean, people talk about enthusiasm. There is not a lot of enthusiasm to vote for Hillary Clinton, but people are still voting for her in the Democratic camp. This might have hurt enthusiasm But that doesn't necessarily mean that people didn't go turn out to vote. Everything I think you said is exactly right about the original sin being on the 5th of July. Of course, the original sin is that Hillary Clinton had a server of her own outside of the rules. But in his letter, why didn't he say, we don't have a warrant yet and we haven't read the emails? I mean, well, strike that. Maybe he read the emails without a warrant, which would be wrong.
No, he didn't. Or at least he should.
Well, I know. Okay, but let's imagine that he read that they read the emails even though they didn't have a warrant, and they couldn't put in down in their letter to Congress that they'd done that. But couldn't they convey somehow the idea that the formal investigative look at the emails and the warrant necessary to do that hadn't been issed, so that there wouldn't be all of this this amazing speculation?
Yeah, I mean, my speculation about this is that, so we know that the Department of Justice did not want Comey to make this move and issue this letter. You know, Loretta Lynch didn't forbid him from doing so and didn't fire him. I think if she had, that would have been caused enormous problems in itself, because it would seem like such a political move. But she didn't do that. So he went ahead. And I just feel like that letter is written in this very lawyerly way, as if he's just like talking to like a judge. And it wasn't written like I really feel like nobody sat down with him and just talked about clarity and how to talk to the public in a way that was going to convey where they were and where they were not. And it's just very obfuscating, that letter. Of course he should have said, we don't have a warrant. For all we know, these could all be duplicates. We're just at the very beginning of figuring out what's here. And he didn't.
One thing this points out is that this investigation is never going to end. And
although once she's president, she can't be the subject of a criminal investigation, I believe. I think since the 70s, DOJ has said that they're not doing that.
Oh, I don't mean the FBI investigation is never going to end.
You mean this?
I mean that Congress for sure. Is
congressional
going to
hearings?
Investigate
oh, you're
this forever.
Right.
We are literally going to be talking about the same nonsense. Not nonsense. This nonsense alone has an acorn at the bottom of it. But we're going to be talking about this in 2020. It's going to be shocking.
I feel like it's important to just mention that the condemnation of Comey from former prosecutors has been bipartisan and has been vociferous. I mean, I think people who do this job have just been outraged at the way in which Comey politicized the FBI. And, you know, whether Clinton still wins the election or not, the idea that this close to actual voting day, you would have the FBI really interfering and kind of polluting the whole atmosphere around the race, that should really just be distressing to us, I think. Like, no matter what happens, it would be the same thing if he had made an announcement about, you know, his investigation of Trump advisors over Russia, which, you know, has now entered the conversation and all these leaks from the FBI. This is not what we want the FBI to be doing. And there were these very firm protocols in place at the Department of Justice, which Eric Holder, you know, had written down in a, like, letter, that are supposed to prevent this from happening. We should not be having pre-indictment messages and shadow casting from the FBI affecting people's judgment of a candidate on the eve of an election.
That last point about the restrictions is really important, because Comey said, well, he told Congress that he would let them know if the investigation picked back up again. And he was saying he was, you know, staying true to that promise. But that promise is just a verbal promise he made, which is not stronger than the prohibitions against meddling in elections 60 days before the election, which I guess my point is that what you were talking about, Emily, is a formal rule as opposed to the informal promise that Comey made in his testimony when he was trying to clean up for the July 5th press conference.
Right. And he just doesn't want it. He just doesn't want after the election for Republicans to know that he had this data and or had inklings of it, and for them to accuse him of having covered something up before the election. He cares much more about protecting his own reputation and the Bureau's reputation than he does about the impact on the election, which is not surprising, but depressing.
And yet also the Bureau's reputation and his reputation have ended up taking a huge hit. I mean, he is being pilloried all over Washington and the country by political allies.
Not by Republican, not by the Republic, not by the Republicans in the House who will be
ecstatic.
They're ecstatic, and they just will. He will be in better shape after the election with them than he would be had were this to come out after the election.
That's true. I'm just surprised. I think of Jim Comey as a fairly upright person, and I'm surprised that's the audience that loomed so large in his mind as opposed to his peers in law enforcement. And maybe that was naive of me.
Well, we don't. I mean, that's all speculation. But what does seem to be true is that if you were trying to protect the FBI reputation, not working for either side, but just trying to protect the FBI reputation, and you knew what a damage it would take if you did nothing, and then it came out after the election that you had this, that this investigation was, or that you had this other cache of things you should have been or were investigating, I can understand that. But but I still come back to the, if you were trying to protect the reputation of the FBI, you would have written a more clear statement that said, this is what we have. I feel obligated because I told you that I would tell you to tell you, but we don't know what we have. And that's the thing that just keeps befuddling me, because by not doing that, he's heaped all this more calumny on himself.
Well, and in fact, he wrote a letter like that to the FBI employees, which promptly leaked. I mean, even that letter, it wasn't perfect, but it was better than his public statement.
Except that letter said, you know, because I'm worried about misinterpretation. And then in the public letter, or in the, not the public letter, but the letter he sent to Congress, it was as if it was written to conjure misinterpretation, and not necessarily for the benefit of one side or the other, but definitely to the detriment of the FBI and himself. So that's the thing. You would think simple self-interest would have caused him to write a more clear letter. Anyway.
Right. I mean, remember, he's a lawyer, an FBI official. He's not a communicator to the public. And I think that and he must have really been doing this basically not on his, I don't know, entirely on his own, but without the kind of, you know, public relations help from the Department of Justice that maybe could have fended this off. The last thing about this that I find really distressing is the leaks. I mean, the idea that every detail we're finding out, whether it's about, you know, the Huma emails, the Clinton Foundation, the Russia-Trump connection, it's all just leaking from unidentified people who seem to have their own axes to grind within the FBI or within DOJ. And that is just not the right way for us to be getting this information. It's crazy.
Yeah, you know, it is crazy, Emily. On the other hand, as a journalist, if this were different circumstances, a different, less heated environment, you would be applauding the noble public servants who are speaking out against the organizational dysfunction of the FBI. So
I don't know.
So be careful.
True, David.
Be careful. I mean, be careful about wishing away leaks.
But I'm not talking about. Look, there. I think it's important to distinguish among different kind of leaks and what. How you can trust the information that gets leaked. I mean, when you have anonymous people calling up reporters from inside the FBI, and different sides of this fight seem to have different reporters they prefer to talk to, how the hell do you know whether it's true or not?
And there's a difference between a leak of a document that tells you some fact and what, Emily, you're talking about, which is the day after Comey's announcement, there were three different stories about where the emails, where they were and whose laptop. And I mean, it was just, it contributed to the confusion. It did not add what a leak of official documents would do, which is, you know, attempts to add clarity.
Right. It feels like we should be getting the actual true details that are relevant to explaining Comey's letter, not like a total mishmash of different versions so that, you know, depending on which publication you read, you hear that these absolutely are emails to and from Hillary Clinton. No, they're not. Well, actually, we don't know yet. I mean, that's just like, that's not a good way to talk to the public.
Let's end there. Although I will say the funniest thing I saw was a Dave Weigel tweet. I don't think it was his point, which is that the fact that Anthony Weiner is still alive disproves the theory that the Clintons have their enemies killed.
That's macabre and yet funny.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All right. We were going to have a segment about Trump and taxes and Russia. And for all I know, John and Emily are still going to insist that we do it because, of course, there was yet more information, yet more shocking information about Trump and his taxes this week. And it would be no doubt public minded and useful and would advance the interests of the country if we had a reasoned and deep discussion of those issues. I, however, am incapable of having a discussion of those issues. I don't want to have a discussion of those issues because I am not in a state to engage rationally on these issues anymore. I'm in a panic. In fact, Atlas Obscura wisely is calling this week Panic Week. All our stories are about panic.
Oh, good. You're just adding fuel to the fire.
Adding fuel to the fire, exactly. Well, it was when we decided.
Should be where we go for like delightful relief.
Well, truly, truly, it is a fine reprieve for me. That's for sure. I cannot read any more about this. I'm not sleeping. I'm waking up in horror dreams. I had a dream last night. I'm engaged in deep conversation with Arianna Huffington. My God. Jesus.
Was the conversation itself about sleep?
What was her take?
We weren't actually talking about the election.
Oh. You were talking about sleep, which is her big project, is getting people to sleep.
She was helping you.
That would have been great. A conversation with Arianna Huffington about sleep that was itself a dream.
Yet it was not restful, so it didn't serve the purpose. But the all of which is to say is that I'm in a state of high anxiety. I know that other people are in a state of high anxiety, existential dread. How can we get through these last few days in a sane way? I want your advice. I have a few thoughts myself. I personally don't want to listen to any podcasts. I don't want to listen to this podcast. I don't know why anyone is listening to this podcast. I don't want to watch John on TV. I don't want to read the newspaper. I don't, for fear of what's in there. I'm hoping for some good sports to be on this weekend. I'm not even sure yet. But what
here's
can we
a question.
Do?
I don't know what the answer to that is, but here's a question. Does one type of supporter or another rush to the internet to seek confirmation that it's all going to be okay? Or do they both in equal numbers seek diversionary pleasures to keep their mind off the horrible thing?
I'm not going to seek solace on the internet this time. I did back in 2008, I think, when I was interested in how that election would turn out.
But you were like on 538 every second, or you were looking at other corners?
On 538, just looking at the numbers, saying, oh, this is going to turn out well for the candidates I support. I think maybe because the campaign has gone on so long that I just can't, it's unendurable. My thought is that I would like to spend the weekend on some big project. I would like to engage.
Distracted.
Cooking something, you know, roasting a whole pig. I actually ordered, there's a maker project. I want to make a compressed air rocket with my kids for a maker fair. And so I've ordered some of the materials for that. And I'm hoping they'll get here by this weekend so I can spend all of Saturday or Sunday making a compressed air rocket, which will be really fun. But I need help. Help.
I think distraction is a really good idea. And my husband's actually going away from Thursday to like Saturday night. And my kids and I decided that we needed a news blackout basically while he was away, and Sunday too. It's pointless and it's such a waste of time. Let's just all do something else and like enjoy apple picking or whatever.
And will you both return to Election Day? I mean, Emily, professionally, you have to, but will you, David, approach Election Day with a sort of let me know when it's over, or will you be following sort of county by county?
I'll be following because I think I'm actually doing, there's a live gist at the Bell House in New York, which I'm somehow part of. So I assume I will be there paying attention. Election Day itself and that period of news blackout, unless there's somebody who has amazingly reliable information that they're feeding me about what's going on from the exit polls, I probably will again try to distract myself. Fortunately, I have an entire job, and which has nothing to do with the election, and I will spend a lot of my time thinking about that as I should. And that is a relief. You, John, have no such relief. And I guess you don't even seek it because you're a fish in water for this. I honestly, John, do not know how you can be pickled in this day after day after day after day without relief. Seems too
But since
stressful.
You're immersed in it, before we go on our news blackout, can you tell us that great rundown of which counties to look for?
I was just going to suggest that I've done two Face the Nation Diaries, which is the little podcast I do, one on Ohio and one on North Carolina, which go county by county, not county by county, but, you know, in North Carolina, it's a state where you sort of separate it in three sections. Democrats do well on in the sort of middle section. Republicans do well out west. And it breaks down the state by its big cities and the big areas where Democrats will have to do well and Republicans will have to do well. So if people are not following the path you are, that's where they should go. I can't go through all of the sort of 13 or 11 battleground states, but I think if you want the fast version of that, I think you have to watch. I mean, remember, if Hillary Clinton wins, basically takes the Democratic states and then wins Florida, it's done. If she wins Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, it's done. If she wins Ohio, it's over. So the first things to watch for also then, in addition to those states, if you're in Pennsylvania, what's the African-American turnout in Philadelphia? And then what's the, where are Republicans going in the collar counties around Philadelphia? Are they turning out in, you know, how big a drop in the white college-educated women is Trump having in reality? Is it as bad as we've seen it in the polls? And is there some amazing and incredible spike around Youngstown in Ohio and in Scranton? Has the silent majority Trump voter shown up?
And that would be the Trump supporting silent majority, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's true. If both sides turn out their base, I think Hillary Clinton wins. I think if neither side, if it's depressed for both sides, I think Hillary Clinton wins. And I think I'm basically echoing what the good people at 538 are saying, which seems right to me. But if Hillary's down and Trump is up, if the rallies do more, what we found in our polling is that there was, particularly in like some place like Pennsylvania, that the explanation for why Trump was 8 points behind in our poll was basically that he was only getting 78% of Republicans. That his challenge is not, he can get people to a rally. He can get 30,000 people in a stadium and they are so happy for him. And they are so psyched. And there's huge intensity for a portion of his coalition. But the coalition he needs has to be bigger than that. And he has to turn out traditional Republicans. That's the question is, you know, was he able to do it in the right number of states? You want to pay a lot of attention.
Can I just say you're doing absolutely nothing to allay whatever anxieties? I thought we were having a conversation
because I thought our listeners might want some John Dickerson wisdom as they head into
Tuesday. They want suggestions about how to spend their weekend.
Well, what suggestions are you doing to spend their weekend don't pay to, you know, either if you don't want to pay attention to the race, go do whatever the thing you love and gives you the most joy is. And if you care about the race, go find out what the five things are you should be paying attention to so that when you have the race, that will give you a sense of
volunteer to try to knock on doors in a swing state, either side.
But
that's another way to manage anxiety, to like walk into the heart of the beast and try to do something about it.
Anyway, just to finish what I was saying is if you look at for what are the like five things you should be paying attention to, it means when election day comes, it's not going to be just a blizzard of information. You'll say, okay, have African-Americans, which are 22% of the population of North Carolina, turned out? And if they turned out, then if I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter, then I'm psyched about that. If they haven't turned out and I'm a Donald Trump supporter, then North Carolina might go to Trump and that'll be good
for
him.
The other thing I've been trying to hold in mind is that when we know the outcome of the election, that will be plenty of time to think about what comes next, whatever it is. There's sort of no point in trying to game it out now, and pre-worrying is useless. Like, it just makes this moment feel worse, and it doesn't accomplish anything. I know that's more rational than I usually actually manage to follow through on, but I think it's true.
No, it's absolutely useless. It's absolutely pointless what I'm doing. It's super frustrating to me personally because I'm somebody who's pretty good about not worrying about things I can't control, and so I'm mad at myself. Layered on top of my anxiety is self-flagellation. because that's exactly right. But be that as may, I'm still anxious. John, what's the earliest key state that reports?
North Carolina closes at 7:30, the polls.
So polls close at 7 in Virginia. So now here's the super important thing. When the polls close and when the votes come in are very, you know, there's huge gaps between that. And particularly like in a state like Virginia, okay, it closes at 7. And the way the votes come in, Fairfax County, which if you're a Clinton supporter is an area she has to do well in, comes in late. It is possible that the Western, you know, Trump will do well in the West. And then there might, remember in 14 when the Senate race in Virginia was kind of a surprise that night. It was closer than people thought. In part, that was because of the way the reporting comes in, that it was, I mean, it was still closer than people thought, but in the end, it wasn't as close as some of the coverage on election night because of the late arrival of votes. I think it's also true that absentees are counted like their own counties, so those come in later. Anyway, so I guess the point is just, this is obviously Cuyahoga County and Ohio is notorious for coming in late. Anyway, so Virginia will come in at 7. North Carolina, as Emily said, is 7:30. 8 o'clock is the, you know, big closures in Florida and Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania doesn't have the kind of early vote that they do in Florida. So it's going to take, there's going to be a lot of, you know, counting takes a while. So I think the earliest you're going to know, I mean, unless it's like a total, total blowout, probably not till, you know, 11, 12.
All right. Oif. Oif kafoif.
We all need to come up with fun outings over the weekend, except for John, who has to do a television show, and then put our seatbelts on Tuesday.
What outing are you doing, Emily? Are you apple picking?
I'm not sure. It's the one weekend that my kids don't have a soccer game. I actually wish that they did have a soccer game because I find that really relaxing. So yeah, maybe we'll go for a hike or go apple picking.
Good idea.
I like your maker project because that's like really, that will occupy your mind, distraction.
Right. I also think I need to cook something big. I'll probably do
that. That's a really good idea. I think I'll cook something big on Saturday too.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
Let us go to cocktail chatter. When you're cooking that huge thing on a Saturday night or a Sunday night, attempting to distract yourself from the race, or in John's case, to gird yourself for 48-hour sprint, what are you going to be chattering about with your loved ones, Emily?
The Supreme Court took, so far, the most interesting case of the term last week, this week, I'm a little lost time-wise, when it decided to hear the case of Gavin Grimm. He is a high school student, I believe, who sued his school board for not letting him use the bathroom for the boys. He's a transgender boy. This is in Gloucester County, Virginia, and he wanted to go to the bathroom with the boys. He is taking hormones, you know, has male features and is a 17-year-old. So he's on the cutting edge of this national fight over transgender use of bathrooms, especially in school locker rooms and restrooms. And the Supreme Court is going to hear this case, I guess, probably sometime this spring, which will be really interesting. And there's a tricky administrative law kind of question in this case about the type of regulation the Department of Justice issued to give transgender kids access to the bathroom of their choice. DOJ did not go through what's called the notice and comment rule process in issuing this guidance to schools. And so that's the sort of boring but important issue. And then there are, you know, these sort of basic equal rights questions at stake in this case.
Cool. John Dickerson, what is your chatter?
My chatter is that after the election, I'm one of the ways I'm going to reorient my life is by participating in one of the Slate Great Books conversations, which I'm really looking forward to with Laura Miller. And so we have announced the four books from which we will choose one to read. They are War and Peace, Madame Bovary, Brothers Karamazov, or Dickens's Our Mutual Friend. And so people can vote and see which of those ones they want to read. And so they can read it along with us, and we'll...
I've never even heard of that Dickens title.
Our Mutual Friend? You haven't read that?
It's his last one.
It's a great book.
Really?
Great book. Really good book.
Oh, I have to go read it.
Really good. Have you read Bleak House, Emily?
Yeah, I love Bleak House. Bleak House is awesome.
I've never read The Brothers Karamazov or any Dostoevsky.
That's crazy. Really? You? Yeah. You are like the best read person. You should go read that. You would love it.
Well, anyway, whatever we read, it'll be a joy for everyone.
Have you read all of them, John?
No. In fact, I've only read Madame Bovary. That just wasn't those. I mean, I definitely was assigned. I'm trying to think which of those I've read lots of other Dickens, but I haven't read Our Mutual Friend. I'm sure. I mean, I've had War and Peace and Brothers Karamazov on my shelves for years, and I don't know whether it's because I was assigned them and didn't read them. Or they're the kinds of books, of course, I am embarrassed for having not read them. So I don't know which it is. But I have the Norton edition of Brothers Karamazov, and I can't remember on War and Peace. But anyway, you know, either whatever the outcome of the people's vote, I will be delighted. Unlike David's posture towards the election.
Maybe that's a good distraction technique for this weekend. Like, get involved, binge watch a great TV show, or read an amazingly absorbing book.
I'm too restless for that. I need physical action. I don't think I could manage that. I need to yah-yah myself. I may need to take like a 100-mile bike ride. That might be better.
That's actually a really good idea. Extreme exercise. Or just exercise.
My chatter. Do you think our presidential campaign is screwed up? Fortunately, we are not South Korea. The presidential scandal in South Korea is so fantastically bizarre that it makes what's going on here seem tame by comparison. I am going to not go into all the details because I don't know them. I would strongly recommend that everyone look at the blog post. Ask a Korean has a great rundown of the scandal, which is consuming Korea around President Park, who is apparently in the thrall of a Rasputin-like woman named Choi Soon-sil, who is herself, Choi Soon-sil is herself the daughter of a cult leader who had President Park's father, who was also the president of South Korea, in his thrall. And Choi Soon-sil is sort of involved in this cult, but is also just a corrupt figure who has been pulling the strings around President Park for years and been incredibly corrupt and bribing it. But it is all exploded because there was a college admissions process. Choi Soon-sil rigged college admissions to help her daughter, and that outraged Koreans. But the details about the stuff that were going on between President Park and Choi Soon-sil are just incredible. There's this thing where Park gave her a budget to purchase the presidential wardrobe, and Choi embezzled most of it and bought really cheap clothes made of subpar material. And there's an incredible video of Choi's staff smoking and drinking while eating fried chicken right next to President Park's suit. And at one point, one of the staff members like has chicken grease all over his clothes and is handling President Park's suit. And so the whole thing is so baroque. It's not to be believed. So I would recommend that you look at this Ask a Korean blog post and just read about this fantastically weird scandal. Our intern is Kevin Townsend. Our producer is Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. Our show page is slate.com/GabFest, which has links to what we talked about today. Facebook page is facebook.com/GabFest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Email address is gabfest@slate.com. Remember, email us or tweet at us using #conundrum with your conundrum. Subscribe to the GabFest on iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. Subscribing, commenting, and rating really help us. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll see you after the election.
Hi. This is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.